Good afternoon, and thank you for tuning in to Faith and Reason here on Holy Family Radio, Grand Rapids, Kalamazoo. This is your host, Dr. John Pinero. Some of you know that I direct a program at Aquinas College here in Grand Rapids called the Catholic Studies Program. And we bring in a lot of speakers as part of our Catholic Studies speaker series. We've had George Weigel and Peter Kraft in recent years, the philosopher Eleanor Stump, my good friend Eduardo Echevarria from Sacred Heart Seminary over in Detroit. And I'm excited that our guest today on the program will also be part of that speaker series on September 9th at 7 p.m. in Waggy Ballroom. And that is Joseph Pierce. Many of you listeners will be familiar with Pierce's work, I think, on Hilaire Belloc or G.K. Chesterton, perhaps his works on Shakespeare. Joseph Pierce is the author of many, many books. In fact, when we were talking before the show, I told him I'd like to talk about your new book, and he said, which one? And, of course, immediately I had to fight those feelings of jealousy as an academic who takes – I take 5 years to write a book. I think Mr. Pierce, maybe 5 minutes. He might have written a new one right now while he was waiting for me. Welcome to the program, Joseph.
My pleasure. Thank you for the compliment.
Yes, your output is just stunning, mostly stunning because it's all so good. It would be easy to write a lot of bad books, but you've written a lot of very, very good books.
Well, thank you. I mean, obviously, I try to keep standards up, but God's good to me. He's given me a gift to be able to write freely, and I thank him for that, and long may it continue.
I recall fondly, I hope you remember this, that you gave another talk in Grand Rapids. I want to say it was 2004 or 5 for a Chesterton Institute fundraiser. I think you spoke on G.K. Chesterton. And I recall I was new to Grand Rapids, and I thought, wow, are there great events like this all the time? After the lecture, we and a few other folks went over to a local restaurant here. I had quite an adventure getting there. I'm not sure you knew you were driven the wrong way down a one-way street, but I knew that because we were in the car behind you. It'll be good to have you back in Grand Rapids.
Well, I'm looking forward to my return. I said I do a lot of traveling, but I haven't been back in that neck of the woods for a while, so it will be good to be back there.
Well, you are at, I guess, what I at Aquinas College Grand Rapids call the other Aquinas College in Nashville. I was hoping before we get started in talking about your books, you might tell us about your move to Nashville, to Aquinas College there, as director for the Center for Faith and Culture.
Yes, indeed. As of July the 1st, I'm the writing residence and director of the Aquinas Center for Faith and Culture at Aquinas College in Nashville, Tennessee, which is run by the Nashville Dominicans, that wonderful religious order down there. I'm very excited to take on that new position. I'm hoping that we can build the Aquinas Center for Faith and Culture into a catalyst for the cultural evangelization of the winning souls to orthodoxy through the power of Catholic beauty. So that's my hope, and it's a very exciting adventure I'm just embarking upon down there in the South, and I'm looking forward to it. I would say, however, that I've thoroughly enjoyed my 2 years at Thomas More College in New Hampshire here, which is a wonderful liberal arts school.
Yeah, the Thomas More College, we have a good relationship with them. The folks who direct their Rome semester program also direct ours at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, so we actually share the same, our students go in the same program. And, yeah, it's a good college, and I used to live in Knoxville, Tennessee, and I'm familiar with your Aquinas College, and I hope you like Middle Tennessee. It's really a wonderful place to live, Tennessee. I think you'll
enjoy it. And I love the area, and I have spoken at Aquinas College in the past. I gave a keynote address at a fundraiser there a few years back, and I spoke at the college itself on Chesterton also more recently. So I have a past relationship with them, but it's very nice to formalize it. You know, with a position with the faculty there. So, yes, very exciting.
Now, your book, Race with the Devil, is quite a departure from talking about the participants of the Catholic literary renaissance of the 20th century. I think most of us had gotten used to waiting for your latest book on one of the Inklings or, you know, a new take on somebody like Oscar Wilde or Maurice Baring, any one of these characters. And lo and behold, you come and write an autobiography, which you've titled Race with the Devil, My Journey from Racial Hatred to Rational Love. And you know, even quite an interesting introspective photograph of you on the cover, I would say. I guess I would like to know what led you to write an autobiography. I think I would be I don't know that I'd want people to know that much about me, but I know, thankfully, St. Augustine disagreed and wrote his own autobiography. What led you to write such a book as this?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned St. Augustine there. Of course, he blazed the trail with the genre of autobiography, of course, with his Confessions. And we all know what a powerful force for good St. Augustine's Confessions have been across the centuries. And my main motivation for writing my own conversion story was hopefully to fulfill the same function. Obviously, I don't expect to have the same impact as St. Augustine, but you know, that ultimately that I can bring souls to Christ and bring souls to the truth by sharing my own journey from, you know, from a very anti-Catholic, racist, white supremacist position, a position full of hatred and bitterness and bigotry, through the power of reason and through the power of love, to come to the fullness of Christian truth in Christ Church. So I'm hoping it's going to be a powerful witness in an age of skepticism, if you like, of the power of the good, the true, and the beautiful to win hearts for Christ, even those that are so far away from him that you think they were beyond redemption. And I'm hoping that my book will show that nobody is beyond the reach and love of Christ.
Well, let's start with where you were before those transcendents, those the true, the good, and the beautiful affected your life so greatly and allowed, I would say, you to affect the lives of a lot of others with your writings and your work. Where were you? I think our listeners would like to know how far did you have to go? Where was the bottom for you, in other words?
Right, well, as my accent no doubt indicates, I'm not an American. Well, actually, I am now. I'm a U.S. citizen, but I'm not a Native American. I wasn't born here. I'm from England originally. I was born in London. And at the age of 15, I joined a white supremacist organization in England called the National Front. We, amongst its policies was the demand for the compulsory expulsion of all non-whites from the United Kingdom. So a racist party, a white supremacist party, you could even say a neo-Nazi party. So I got involved in that at the age of 15, and at the age of 16 I founded a magazine called Bulldog, which was the newspaper of the Young National Front, the youth movement of the National Front, and it was for my editing of that I was sent to prison on two separate occasions.
What was London like in the late 1970s, in this time period that I think you're talking about here, the late 70s, the early 80s? I think of things like, oh, I don't know, the punk rock movement and other things. I'm just wondering what would draw a 15-year-old boy into a group such as the National Front to the point of, you know, rising to be an editor of a magazine and to be pushing such a thing as the expulsion of non-whites from the UK?
Well, it was a time of very, very heightened racial tension. The white people, the young white people of England were very, very aggressive towards non-whites, and there was a lot of racial violence on the streets. That was the backdrop. In many ways, it was the antithesis. If you like, this is the 1960s, the idea of the hippies and that sort of summer of love and all that. Well, by the late 1970s, it was the summer of hate, literally. You know, there was a punk rock, which was very negative, very anarchistic, and the rise of the skinhead movement, which was basically a neo-Nazi, and a backdrop of racial violence. So it was actually that England and particularly London and the big cities of England in the late 1970s were violent, was a violent place.
Now, for the neo-Nazis and for groups in the United States, like the Ku Klux Klan, which was founded originally to oppose black Republican rule in the South following the Civil War, and then it kind of died away for a while once that actually was successful, only to be reborn again in Indiana, actually in the 1920s, as an anti-Catholic, anti-Semitic, and anti-black organization. I'm wondering about the religious element here that seems to follow these types of organizations. That is the anti-Catholicism and particular. This was at almost really the high point, I would say, of in retrospect of the troubles in Northern Ireland. Any of that figure in here?
Yeah, well, first of all, I was brought up by my father to be anti-Catholic. My father referred to Catholics as bead rattlers, I was brought up to be antagonistic towards Catholicism anyway, and that was exacerbated by the troubles in Northern Ireland. I became very, very heavily involved with the Protestant side in Northern Ireland and got involved with the two terrorist organizations that opposed the IRA. I was involved with the Ulster Defence Association, or the UDA, and also the Ulster Volunteer Force, the UVF. And I joined an anti-Catholic secret society called the Orange Order, sort of like Freemasons that only exist to hate the church, basically. So I was very, very anti-Catholic, as well as being anti-black and a racist. I was also very much an anti-Catholic bigot.
2 years ago, I was in at a place called Corrymeela in outside Ballycastle in County Antrim in Northern Ireland. As part of the director of a grant through the Lilly Foundation to organize a peace and reconciliation seminar. We had a number of people who came and talked to our group. These were all American and Canadian academics. And we had former members of the two groups you mentioned, and we were there in July. So we were taken to see what we were told was the most sedate bonfire possible in Belfast. And it really was striking to see these things up close, what I had always read and heard about in America. And it seemed to me that even the Protestant Society of Northern Ireland, there was such a divide between the poor and the wealthier members, between those who seemed involved in celebrating the bonfires and some of the people who I saw at an orange parade where I tried to be incognito, but the television cameras came up and interviewed me because I must have looked not very incognito. And it was just a very odd experience to me, the whole thing, just what was still, I thought, seething beneath the surface. And I don't know how, outside of grace, a problem like that is solved. I don't know if you have any comment on any of that.
Well, the scars in Northern Ireland go very, very deep, and they go back for centuries. So thanks be to God, the Good Friday Agreement of the late 1990s has for the most part held. But, you know, there were riots for days on end earlier this year, or sorry, late last year, when the Belfast City Council decided to no longer fly the Union Jack outside Belfast City Hall, and there were nights upon nights of very violent clashes with petrol bombs being thrown and shots being fired. So you know, it's still seething under the surface there. It's a dangerous and very sectarian society where amongst the so-called Protestants, I say so-called Protestants, by the way, because what you have to understand is that this is tribal. I never went to church. I was basically an agnostic, but I was an anti-Catholic agnostic. And you know, many of the Protestants, so-called Protestants in Northern Ireland, are not churchgoers. They don't really care about religion, but they're part of the Protestant tribe, and they hate the Catholics. So it's very much a tribal thing, and that's still seething, and the scars run deep. And thanks be to God, they're not planting bombs at the moment, and they're not shooting each other. But it's always there under the surface. It could flare up at any time.
Yeah, when I was there, we were told that the young people burning the bonfires in Belfast had been forbidden by their elders, by their local rulers in town, to put the Irish flag on top or to burn the Pope in effigy, two things which had been common.
Yeah.
And so what many of them had, which I guess funny is the wrong word, was a flag of the soccer team Glasgow Celtic,
right.
a soccer team founded by a Catholic priest. Yeah. But about halfway through, there went on the Pope and there went on the Irish flag. And it just struck me as kind of like a teenage rebellion. And when you're talking about culture, that changes slowly, I think.
Absolutely. And also, you know, that these young people growing up now, they may not necessarily even remember the troubles that ended in the late 1990s. But, you know, their fathers were involved, their parents were involved, and they probably have uncles that were either in prison or parents that were in prison, or were killed or wounded during those troubles. So, you know, that the shadow of the troubles is still very much a part of the culture over there. And so even the people that may be only 15 years old now that therefore have never known the real violence that was in Northern Ireland in the late 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, nonetheless, if you like, bearing the collective communal scar that culture has.
Well, so this was the milieu in which you were a young man, and as you tell in the book, you went to even were sent to prison twice, it was there that your life began to change, and that's what I'd like to focus on now, if we may. That is really the subtitle of your book, right? Your journey from that revolutionary spirit of the National Front. And on into the Catholic you've become and are still becoming. All of us are, of course, involved in this constant conversion in our lives. What is there a moment in time or a particular person you could point to where you felt your heart began to change in a big way, or your mind turned towards God and away from this hatred?
Well, you know, I think there are two, in the broadest sense of the word, there are two types of conversion. There's the St. Augustine conversion, which is, if you like, a slow conversion over a long period of time, and with significant moments along the way. And then there's the one sort of crash conversion of a St. Paul on the road to Damascus, sort of an incident that changes you forever in a radical way. Well, my conversion is more of a St. Augustine conversion than a St. Paul one, in the sense that, you know, it begins really with my first reading of G.K. Chesterton when I was a young man in my late teens. And obviously, well, it hasn't ended now because I'm still growing in the faith. But, you know, but should we say, for the point of view of keeping it simple here, you know, it ends with my reception into the Catholic Church in 1989 when I'm 28 years old. So the period between when I first read Chesterton and when I was received into the church was a period of about 9 or possibly even 10 years, so a decade. The whole of the 1980s, really, was a progress from this sort of anti-Catholic, racist position towards slowly an embrace of the Catholic position and then an acceptance of the Catholic Church. So there were significant moments along the way, as they were for St. Augustine, as he tells us in the Confessions, but not a one sort of crash moment of conversion.
Yeah, whatever it takes, I think, is what God's willing to do for us in these kinds of conversions, right? Some of us are a harder nut to crack, I think.
Yeah, exactly. I was so far from the church and so far from an understanding of, love the Lord thy God and love thy neighbor when I was in the radical politics, that it would have taken an absolute miracle for some sort of blinding, sort of one moment to bring me across. What was needed was I see two things happening. At the time I saw it, when I became a Catholic, looking back at the previous decade, I thought this was a process that was entirely rational. I came to Catholicism through a process of reason, which is why the book's subtitled from Racial Hatred to Rational Love. There was an absolutely rational, philosophical and theological dimension to my moving closer to Christ and His Church. But what I didn't realize at the time that was also happening was a supernatural healing process, because there are certain aspects of one's, shall we say, deeply ingrained prejudices, one's racism, for instance, one's anti-Catholicism, that are so, in some ways pathological, and that requires not merely, you can't just reason your way out of those prejudices, because the prejudices themselves blind you to reason. You have to be healed. So there was this healing hand of grace simultaneously with a rational engagement of the mind. And those two things working together over a period of 10 years brought me from the one extreme position into the Catholic Church.
What was it by Chesterton that you read? Do you remember?
Well, the first book, see, what you have to understand is nobody would have got me to read a book in defense of the Catholic Church. I wasn't the least bit interested, and I would have refused to read it. But I was interested in politics, and you know, that I was the communists were basically calling our people in a violent demonstration on the street, when they weren't throwing bricks at us, they were throwing insults at us, including that you are just the stormtroopers of capitalism. And my attitude was, you know, that that I don't like communism, I don't like socialism, I don't like big government, but that doesn't necessarily mean I want the world being run by the International Monetary Fund or by global corporations that are not democratically elected, etc. So I was interested in politics, and someone said, well, have you looked at the political ideas and the economic ideas of G.K. Chesterton? And of course I hadn't. But they said that I should read one particular essay by Chesterton in a book called The Well and the Shallows. So I bought that book to read that one essay, but I started from page one. And the rest of the book was a defense of the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church was the well, you know, it has life-giving waters, and it has depth and profundity. And the shallows, all the various sort of worldly ideologies, including the new heresy of race. The book was published in 1935, you know, 2 years after Hitler had come to power. So Chesterton's addressing all of these issues. I couldn't help, I didn't agree with everything Chesterton wrote, of course, when I first read that first book. I didn't like his Christianity, but I couldn't help agreeing with his politics and liking his sense of humor, liking the way that he wrote, that was the beginning of an appetite for more Chesterton. And then through Chesterton, I developed an appetite for Hilaire Belloc, and then I discovered C.S. Lewis, and eventually John Henry Newman, and in prison, I discovered St. Thomas Aquinas. You know, so it was an ongoing process from that sort of acorn sort of planted in the buying the one Chesterton book for one essay. From that acorn, if you like, grew the oak tree of faith that led me into the church.
Yeah, that's a very beautiful story. So you just keep going back to Aquinas and probably to Augustine as well. Now, the Well and Shallows, I think, is just it's a wonderful book. In fact, the newsletter for the Catholic Studies program I direct, we call it The Well. And I recall in the first issue we explained why.
Yes.
And we want to keep going back to this well, and it's infinitely rich, really. And so you went from Chesterton to Belloc, so I assume what you're reading about is distributism, and there's been a lot of works written on distributism lately. A lot of my friends here locally in Grand Rapids would put themselves in the distributist camp, but I also have many friends and colleagues at the Acton Institute, which is quite a different Catholic message. Both of them, I think, prudentially okay, but I'd be interested in your thoughts on the matter. That it intrigues me that you're going to the sources of these political and economic ideas by way of the ideas themselves. That is, you don't start at the source and then go out to the political ideas that might be applicable from Catholic teaching, but you're thinking about ways to organize exchange between people. And as you said, big government. You wrote that wonderful tribute to Schumacher. You wrote Small is Still Beautiful. One of your more recent books, I think, is a very good book, and I'd recommend that and Schumacher's original Small is Beautiful. Could you tell us a little bit about distributism and the role that concept played in your being attracted to the Catholic faith?
Yes, indeed. I mean, I've written on distributism again fairly recently. I wrote an article called What is Distributism for the Imaginative Conservative? So I've sort of returned to it somewhat recently. What I would say is that I would agree with Chesterton that distributism is an ugly word. He called it an ugly word. And I think in some ways it's almost an unfortunate word because it's not very clear. I mean, what is being distributed? I mean, it's not saying that the distribution itself is good, which, you know, the word distributist would imply. Let's just distribute things. I mean, is it the redistribution of wealth? Well, that could be Marxist. No, it isn't. What basic distributism is that freedom ultimately is dependent upon the freedom of individuals and families to have control over their own labor. In other words, to ideally own the land on which they live and own the means of livelihood, that sort of, not in a sort of simple sense, the tools with which they work. So in other words, as far as possible, we want as many small businesses as possible so that as many people as possible own their own businesses. And when that's not possible, then in the small businesses, at least people are working in what Schumacher would call human-scale environments. Even the employees in a small business are working in a human-scale environment, as opposed to those working for global corporations where they're one of only, you know, possibly hundreds of thousands of employees. And also connected to that is, of course, small government. That, you know, freedom also requires that government be brought back closer to the people. So, you know, if, for instance, it would be for devolving power away from the encroachments of a bigger and bigger federal government back towards local government and state government, to bring government back closer to the people, to become more genuinely democratic. So these are sort of the distributist ideas, and I was very attracted to that when I was a young man. Another book that had a healthy impact upon me was reading George Orwell's 1984, which turned me against totalitarianism, which is also, of course, another significant step in the right direction and away from my previous Nazi sympathies. So, you know, the idea that Big Brother and big government are pernicious, and that freedom really is dependent upon government being cut down to size, and that big business also being cut down to size, that was central to my understanding of what justice was about. And of course, once I realized that Chesterton and Belloc advocated that, I also realized, of course, that Chesterton and Belloc were really just adopting the social teaching of the Catholic Church. And that the ideas of distributism were really an adaptation of the ideas expressed by Pope Leo XIII in the Rerum Novarum, and later by Pius XI in Quadragesimo Anno, and more recently by John Paul II in Centesimus Annus, etc. So when I came to realize that the roots of these ideas were not actually Chestertonian and Belloccian, but actually Catholic, then of course that was a further significant a nudge in the right direction to bring me closer to the church. Well, the Catholic Church has the right ideas on these things, but actually it's right in other ways too.
Right, and that, those are things that touch every single human life every day. That is wealth creation and work and labor and family. What a very interesting road into the church.
It's an unusual one, but, you know, as I said, that it's said that all roads lead to Rome, but there are as many roads as there are people.
Yeah.
We all have our own individual roads to Rome. Thanks be to God. God made us to share a common humanity, but also made us unique as individual human persons, and he touches each of us in that individual, unique way.
Now, I know you've also written on C.S. Lewis in your 2003 book, C.S. Lewis and the Catholic Church, and in this book you mention Lewis too. So what intrigued me was that a Protestant man, though perhaps every Catholic's favorite Protestant writer of the 20th century, that a Protestant man from Northern Ireland would play a role in helping convince you of Catholic truth.
Oh, there's obviously a delicious and irony there. I see that my discovery of C.S. Lewis is one of the major minor miracles, if you like, on my path to conversion. What happened was I was browsing through a used bookstore in London, looking probably for books by Chesterton. That was one of my favorite pastimes in those days. And my eyes fell upon a book by C.S. Lewis called Surprised by Joy. And I'm not even sure I'd even heard of Lewis. I think I'd heard of him. I didn't know much about him. I think possibly I knew he was the author of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which I hadn't read. So I didn't know much about him. But something prompted me, I like to think Providence, prompted me to take the book from the shelf. And that book has no index, so I didn't consult the index. But I opened the book at random, and as I opened the book, I opened the book on the page where Lewis talks about his first reading of G.K. Chesterton, this wonderful providential coincidence. And the way that Lewis describes his first reading of Chesterton during the First World War, when Lewis is in the trenches fighting in the British Army during the First World War, at that stage, Lewis is an atheist. And the way he describes his first reading of Chesterton is that, you know, although he was an atheist, and one would expect him to not find anything at all in Chesterton palatable, he couldn't help, you know, falling in love with Chesterton as a writer, and that he believed that Chesterton had more common sense than all the moderns put together, except, of course, his Christianity. And I read that and thought, that's exactly right. That's what I feel, you know, except, of course, his Christianity. And, of course, later in the same book, Lewis says that a sound atheist cannot be too careful of his reading. And it's what's true of a sound atheist is also true of a sound racist. So in Lewis, in continuing to read Chesterton, was led ultimately to conversion. And I, in reading Chesterton, and also then from then on, of course, Lewis, because Lewis now also became a favorite writer of mine, through reading Chesterton and Lewis, I was also led to conversion.
Among my students at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, they absolutely love Lewis. We have a Catholic studies class on Tolkien and Lewis. You know, we have it in the same class, kind of a Catholic imagination class. But in the class I teach, I assign the Everlasting Man, this Christian view of history class that I teach. And what intrigues me is most of them have not read Chesterton, but some of them have. Maybe they've seen Dale Alquist's show on EWTN. But that's about as much as they know of Chesterton. So Chesterton, in many ways, has been either filtered by that EWTN show, or they know very, very, very little about it. But when I tell them about how integral the Everlasting Man was in Lewis's conversion, they perk up immediately.
Yeah.
I mean, if it has anything to do with Lewis, it's just amazing the attraction that man still has, much more so than he had even probably when I was in college back in the late 80s.
Absolutely. Well, of course, Lewis says in Surprised by Joy that on reading Chesterton's The Everlasting Man, he saw the outline of history laid out before him for the first time in a way that made sense. And that was a defining moment on Lewis's path to conversion. And what's wonderful, of course, about this sort of friendship, this affinity between Chesterton and Lewis. They never knew each other personally, of course. Lewis basically started to be published around the time that Chesterton died, but Lewis was a great devotee of Chesterton. And what's ironic, of course, is that for me, Chesterton led me to C.S. Lewis. But for many, many thousands of others, C.S. Lewis has led others to G.K. Chesterton, particularly Protestants. I mean, many Protestants start reading Chesterton because they read what Lewis says about Chesterton and Lewis's admiration for Chesterton. And if Lewis admires Chesterton that much, then Chesterton himself must be worth reading. So Lewis has led many people to G.K. Chesterton.
That reminds me of a comment I heard Peter Crafe make. Well, I've heard him make it a couple times at a couple different lectures he's given in Grand Rapids. And somebody asked him the question that you also deal with in your Lewis book, and that is, why did Lewis not convert to the Catholic faith? He's so Catholic in so many ways. And Professor Crafe's response was, because then Protestants wouldn't read him.
Well, yes. I mean, this is a very complex and potentially controversial topic, of course, because is it good that Lewis was not received into the Catholic Church? Well, I think we'd have to say, in an absolute objective sense, no, it isn't.
Well, yeah.
But nonetheless, in a wider providential sense, if he had been received into the Catholic Church, the Protestants wouldn't trust him and they wouldn't read him. And there's no doubt at all that C.S. Lewis has ushered thousands, probably, of Protestants into the Catholic Church, which would not have been the case had he converted. But the way I like to look at it is that when someone says, was C.S. Lewis a Catholic? Well, I say, well, he is now. Lewis believed in purgatory. He wrote that he believed in purgatory. And not only did Lewis believe in purgatory, he actually stated explicitly that he thought he was going there. And he asked his Anglican nun friend, But he asked her, to visit him in purgatory if it's allowed, after they're both dead. Now, of course, if Lewis is in purgatory, and I'm very happy to believe that he is, I hope to meet him there one day, he's going to heaven, because it's a one-way street. And everybody, yeah, ultimately in purgatory has to embrace the fullness of Catholic truth to be fully Christian in the mystical body of Jesus Christ. So of course Lewis is going to be united with his great friend J.R.R. Tolkien, and please God, if it's the way things work up there, we'll get to meet and have a great time with G.K. Chesterton, and they're all in one communion where it really matters, which is in eternity.
Was it Lewis who brought you to Tolkien? Is that how you found Tolkien and the other?
No, I'd always meant to read The Lord of the Rings, and it was such a a thick book, and I was always told myself I was too busy. And then during my second prison sentence, I was in solitary confinement in my second prison sentence with loads of time on my hands. Well, all of a sudden, Lord of the Rings, the thickness of it became something which was attractive rather than something which deterred me. So I actually read Lord of the Rings during the second prison sentence for the first time. And again, that was another significant nudge in the right direction. I didn't understand all of the Catholic dimension of the Lord of the Rings at the time, but I as with everybody, if you read the Lord of the Rings, you're being moved towards the church, however indiscernibly it might be, you're being nudged in the right direction.
It's interesting you say that, because when I read it, I think I was a freshman in high school, so maybe 14, I think 13, 14, when I first read The Lord of the Rings. And I had never heard about Tolkien's Catholic faith. I just heard it was a great fantasy novel, and this was sort of the trend at that time in the early 80s, fantasy movies, novels, games, the whole works. And I read it, and I have to think in some way it must have worked on me, because I was on my way to being a fallen away Catholic and eventually revert to the faith through Lewis's Mere Christianity, among other works that helped bring me back to the faith. But it's interesting that I can't not see the Catholicism in it now when I read it. But it was very easy to miss when I didn't know what to look for.
I remember Father Fezzio of Ignatius Press, a wonderful Jesuit priest, saying to me that to him, when he first read The Lord of the Rings, the Catholicism was palpitating on every page. And I thought, well, that wasn't how I saw it. But then the difference is, of course, that when he read it, I think he was already a Jesuit, or certainly was very, very Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And so for him it was obvious, because he was much more well-versed in theology than I was at the age of 25 in prison when I first read it. So, you know, I only got, should we say, a vague, hazy impression of something which was good and true and beautiful. But of course, you know, the fullness of the good, the true, and the beautiful is Catholicism. So, you know, and of course now, as with Father Fezzio, that the Catholicism does indeed palpitate on every single page as you read it and reread it.
Do you think very much of the very, very popular movies by Peter Jackson, the Lord of the Rings trilogy that he made about 10 years ago now?
Well, the Lord of the Rings films, it depends what mood I'm in. if I'm wearing my Tolkien purist hat, you know, then when I'm wearing that hat, I come up with a list of things wrong with the movies that are longer than my arm, and they're very irritating. But if I take my Tolkien purist hat off and put my movie lover's hat on, I do actually enjoy the Lord of the Rings movies. I do think there's an element of Jackson's genuine love for the book does come through, and at least there's some sort of impression of the holiness that's in the book comes across in the movies, albeit through a glass darkly. But I would have to distinguish between the Lord of the Rings movies and the Hobbit movies, which are absolutely appalling. The first Hobbit movie was so bad, and then people told me that the second one was worse, and that's all I needed to hear.
They're right.
I refused to watch it. So
I tried to like the Hobbit movies. I was grateful that Peter Jackson was going to do it, because if I thought, well, if they're going to make this into a movie, at least Jackson, even if he didn't know what he was doing, I find a lot of Catholic imagery in the Lord of the Rings films.
Right.
You know, a lot of it made it in, particularly the Galadriel imagery of the Blessed Mother. But wow, the first Hobbit was not much like the Hobbit for one thing. But then the second one was, it was a very much a disappointment.
Yeah.
And so
the thing I find ironic and grimly humorous is that I think that the irony here is that Peter Jackson has the dragon sickness, you know, that he's actually become a sort of like Smaug, where he's more interested in the money than the treasure and the gold that can be made from making a film of The Hobbit than actually genuinely trying to depict authentically the work itself.
And so this is why we have three movies instead of one, and orcs in every scene chasing
exactly.
Everybody. Yeah,
exactly.
Well, you've mentioned truth and goodness and beauty several times, so maybe we can switch gears here and talk about what's your latest book, Beauty as truth. This is a topic that we cover quite a bit on Faith and Reason here on Holy Family Radio, because this is the way a lot of people are drawn to truth and in spite of themselves, through the heart and through the mind, through the senses, and the truth and goodness and beauty that's in the world. These are great avenues to God. I think Von Balthasar and some others have stressed beauty, but others have stressed truth and intellectual pursuits. Why don't you tell us what we can find in your new book, Beauty is Truth?
Well, the important thing is, you know, in an age of relativism, it's very difficult to evangelize people through the power of reason, because objectivity is questioned, and the very, very notion of truth. I mean, the famous question of Pontius Pilate, quid est veritas, that can be asked in two ways. It can be asked in a good way or a bad way. The good way of asking the question, quid est veritas, is to say, quid est veritas, what is truth, as a question to be answered. But the way the relativist asks the question is, what is truth? In other words, there's no such thing, or if there is a such thing, it's unknowable, so it's a waste of time worrying about it. So the question is only asked in a sort of derisory, derogatory, rhetorical fashion. So if that's the case, then it's very difficult to evangelize through the power of reason, because relativists spurn reason. And in an age of romanticism, where it's all about feeling, it's also very difficult to evangelize through the power of love, authentic love, which is about giving ourselves sacrificially for the beloved, for the other. So in a world that's forgotten the true meaning of love, that's forgotten the true meaning of reason, beauty becomes the most powerful way that we can bring people to the truth. And the way I try to explain this is, if you were to put an atheist and an agnostic and a Catholic and a Protestant and a Jew and a Muslim in a field facing east, and they were to watch a beautiful sunrise, they would all be touched by the beauty of that. And the natural response to that beauty is to feel that it's a sense of gratitude, that it's good for us to be here. And what follows on from a sense of gratitude is to ask a question, well, who exactly do I thank? And, of course, this is asking the very important questions that it's very difficult to ask these days. And, of course, the beautiful ultimately leads us back always to the good and the true, because the good, the true, and the beautiful are an image of the Trinity. The more we understand them, the more we see the unity of them. So you get to people through beauty that you can no longer get to them through reason and love, but you bring them through beauty back to a full understanding of the good and the true.
I think ideally that's supposed to be what the Divine Liturgy does, isn't it? I mean, beyond communicating the story, beyond giving us access to the body and blood of Jesus Christ, the liturgy, when we look back at history, as Christopher Dawson, the Catholic historian and writer, shows us, as we look back at history, it's the liturgy that has often converted people through its sheer beauty mixed with mystery, but beauty certainly. I think that's how Thomas Merton described the beginnings of his conversion. He walked in the back door of a church one day during a mass. In those days, it would have been the Tridentine mass, and you know, that was what did it. It just started to draw him in from there, closer and closer, till he was in the front row, you know, after a while.
Yeah. Well, the connection between, as you rightly say, between the numinous and the luminous, you know, the mystery and the light, which you see in the liturgy. The liturgy, of course, is the perfect expression of the goodness, truth, and beauty of God in one, which is why liturgical abuse is such a destructive thing within the church. When the liturgy is turned into something ugly, you know, a great deal of harm is done. I agree with you, and that's a perfect example. But of course, you know, there are many people out there that are not going to go to Holy Mass. What I'm hoping I can engage here is that through the power of beauty, we can engage people and lead them towards goodness and truth, and therefore, of course, ultimately to God and His church.
And so you're not just talking about natural beauty, you're talking about the art, for instance?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the book's divided into four sections. The first part is called defining our terms. So I look at, you know, the central things that are going to be discussed in the work and define exactly what we mean by them. The next part is called celebrating our heritage. And it looks at the history, basically, of Western civilization, the great works of art, music, literature, the heritage we've inherited. And then the next section is literary landscapes, where I look at a Catholic literature in a panoramic sense. So, for instance, there's an article on literature and Catholic social teaching, which goes right back to through the Catholic social teaching and medieval works of literature, right through to modern works of literature. So literary landscapes, and then there's literary portraits, and there's loads of essays, you know, on individual Catholic and Christian writers and aspects of their work. And then the final one is self-portraits, and there's two or three essays at the back about my own conversion and one or two other personal aspects. So the focus is always basically the power of beauty, the evangelizing power of beauty, and the power that beauty has to bring us to the good and the true.
Is this book already available?
Yes, it is. It's okay. Published by St. Augustine's Press. It came out just last week. I'm very, very pleased with it, and I hope people will check it out.
Yeah, excellent. Perhaps we'll talk about this when you come to Aquinas College, our Aquinas College. It's very confusing, isn't it?
There can't be enough Aquinas around.
Well, yeah, we have. There's so many Catholic colleges in the United States named after some form of Thomas Aquinas'
right.
Name.
As there should be. The angelic doctor deserves it.
Yeah. Well, if in our closing minutes here, we have about 10, 12 minutes left in the show, I'd like to take us back to the Inklings, if I might, and this what I would call definitely renewed interest in the Inklings these past 15 years or so, and Lewis and Tolkien certainly moved to the front of that, thanks to a lot of things, thanks mainly to Lewis and Tolkien themselves, but also their boosters and others. Left behind often, though, is somebody you've written about, but I think some of our listeners may not be that familiar with him, and that's Roy Campbell. So I was hoping we could talk for a bit about Roy Campbell, if we have time, Maurice Barry. And these are two people whom Chesterton devotees, especially those who read the Chesterton Review out of Seton Hall University. There's always some of Barry's poetry in there, it seems.
Yeah.
And a lot about Roy Campbell mixed in there as well. What can you tell us about Roy Campbell?
Well, yeah, first of all, you're a man after my own heart, because obviously it's quite clear from my own writings that I'm a great admirer of both Roy Campbell and Maurice Baring. So clearly you and I have much in common. I'm really, really looking forward to enjoying some one-on-one time with you when I'm there in Grand Rapids. But Roy Campbell basically was one of the major poets of the first half of the 20th century. Indeed, by the late 1920s, was actually seen probably as the most important poet in the English language after T.S. Eliot, who was sort of, you know, the main person, if you like. But after Eliot, Campbell was really lauded as maybe the brightest of the new generation of young poets in the English language. So the mystery is, why is he so neglected and largely forgotten today? Well, that's because he had a habit of making enemies. He attacked the Bloomsbury Group, the sort of secularist, nihilistic aspects of the Bloomsbury Group in London. Then he supported the nationalists in the Spanish Civil War, because he was living in Spain at the time. He was recently received into the Catholic Church. And the priest that received him and his wife and daughters into the Catholic Church was murdered in cold blood by the communists. He then befriended some Carmelite monks, one of whom was his and his wife's confessor, and they were all gunned down in cold blood by the communists. So, of course, Roy Campbell saw very, very simply that the communists in Spain were the enemy of Christ, the enemy of Christendom, the enemy of European civilization. And he supported the opposing side, the nationalists in the war. Where in England at the time, you know, the communism was very fashionable, and the nationalists were seen somehow as being sort of too closely associated, perhaps with the fascists in Italy or the Nazis in Germany, unjustifiably. So consequently, Roy Campbell was ostracized and really became someone that was really shunned. And that's the reason this great poet, who really did write some of the finest poetry of the 20th century, is largely neglected today. And I should also mention, by the way, his translations of various writers, Charles Baudelaire, for instance, but especially his marvelous translations of the works of St. John of the Cross. A fine poet, a great poet, and a very controversial and troubled man. And my biography of him, you know, I think brings out, you know, it's not a question of making a saint of him, but certainly by any means, because he had his problems. But he was nonetheless a great poet and a genuine and good convert to the Catholic faith.
I sometimes think that it would be the key to understanding, well, the death toll, among other things, of the 20th century, but just 20th century world history in a general way, but particularly European history and what was once Christendom, if we could understand completely the Spanish Civil War. Not World War I, but the Spanish Civil War. I think that's the one that seems to hold the key to the communists and the secularists and fascism and in many forms and corporatism, and it's all kind of there. I mean, it's bringing everybody in the 1930s.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more that if we actually all study the Spanish Civil War in an objective fashion, see what forces were at work, the forces of anarchy, and the forces of Marxism, the forces of Trotskyism, and these destructive forces, all of which were very anti-clerical, very anti-Catholic, and violently so. I mean, hundreds of priests were killed, a dozen or so bishops, nuns were murdered and raped. This was basically a diabolical manifestation of secular fundamentalism, and it shows, as secular fundamentalism always shows, its deadly face. Now, whether it's the killing of millions of babies in the womb, or the killing of millions of dissidents in the Gulag archipelago under communism, or the killing of people in gas chambers. You know, the secular fundamentalism is deadly. It's the political manifestation of the culture of death.
Yeah, well, very, very well said. Now, in our closing minutes then, we'll try to turn to a more positive look at that time period, but it is interesting, and horribly so, that a time period to produce such great such art and literature is also such a violent time period. But I guess that's not unlike everything from ancient Greece to medieval Europe.
You look at the so-called golden age of the church, you know, and the age of St. Francis and St. Dominic. Well, St. Francis and Dominic came along because the religious orders were corrupt, you know, and then you look at the age of reason in the church, the age of scholasticism under St. Thomas Aquinas, etc. Well, that coincided with a time when there were two or three people claiming to be pope, where the papacy was in exile, being kicked out of Rome. I mean, if you actually, the more you understand history, the more you understand that the one golden rule is there was no golden age. The point is that the Christ and his church are always at war with the world. I mean, Christ said as much. If, you know, if the world has hated me, it will hate you. And I think one of the big problems is the temptation to replace the Holy Spirit with the spirit of the age, and to be seduced by whatever today's worldly fashions are. But the world ultimately is always at war with the church, and that's a reality. And it's not a reality we should worry about, because the church, it's a miracle, considering all of this, that the church is still here after 2,000 years. And the reason the church is still here after 2,000 years is because Jesus Christ promised that the gates of hell will not prevail against it. And so, you know, we know we're on the winning side, but the winning side involves carrying the cross and being nailed to it. And that's what the church's relationship to the world is.
No merely human institution could survive the things that members of the body of Christ have done.
Oh, exactly.
If you want
the proof of the miraculous divinity of the mystical body of Jesus Christ, the Catholic Church, just look at the fact that it's still here in spite of all the enemies from without that have tried to destroy it, and all of the traitors from within that have tried to destroy it. The fact is that doesn't matter how corrupt people in the church are, it doesn't matter how deadly and destructive the enemies of the church outside of it are, the church survives. The church survives because the hand of God is upon it.
So would it be wrong then, as people have accused Chesterton and Belloc of doing, to romanticize the medieval period as a golden era, the 13th century, the golden era of Christendom, when Europe had a fully Christian culture?
Yeah, I think it's a danger to see a golden age in the future, as the progressives do, because that's a myth. And it's a danger to see a golden age in the past, because that's also a myth. Of course we can celebrate the building of the great cathedrals. And of course we can celebrate the theology and philosophy of St. Thomas Aquinas, St. Augustine. But we must at the same time realize and recognize that at the very same time that these wonderful things were happening, horrible things were happening. And so it's not that there was a golden age and somehow everything's gone wrong since then. There's always been a friction and a tension between the sanctity that the church demands and worldliness and sin, which is at war with the church, including, of course, ultimately, as Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, that battle line between sanctity and sin passes through the heart of every single man. So therefore, that battle goes on in the heart of each of us as individuals. And it's only because the church is basically a divine institution, the mystical body of Christ, that it survives that deadly struggle between sanctity and sin.
I feel that struggle on a personal level in terms of Catholic higher education. That is, there's never been a time in the institutions of the church, as you say, have not had a particular level of corruption, and that the good has not had to fight against the bad. And I think in many ways, Catholic higher education has turned a corner, at least from those running away from the faith, because those kinds of colleges they're just gone, really. And they're no longer Catholic. It's a bishops or even saints. So you've been blessed to work at some really strongly and well-known, very orthodox Catholic colleges. Most recently, as you say, at Aquinas College in Nashville. But I do believe, I believe I work at one. There's a lot of Catholic colleges that lost their way that I think are participating in the new evangelization, and hopefully we'll see the fruit of that.
Yeah, I think if you're looking for encouraging signs, I think that the turn in Catholic education in the last 30 years has been very encouraging. I think a great deal of that has to do with the work done by Pope John Paul II and the work done by Pope Benedict XVI.
Absolutely.
And you have all these new young colleges that I, as you rightly say, I've been blessed to be working with and for. And you also have some older institutions that have turned the corner and turned things around and have regained their Catholic identity after what almost like a resurrection, after what it appeared to be its death. It's resurrected. And so there's a struggle going on, and I'm sure in some of those institutions that call themselves Catholic, they basically probably are dead. But there are many others where the battle has been fought and fought well, and the tide has turned. Chesterton, one of my favorite lines from Chesterton is from the Ballad of the White Horse, the high tide King Alfred cried, the high tide and the turn. And I think the high tide of modernism, both in the academy and in the church, was probably in the late 70s, and the tide probably turned from about the time that John Paul II was elected. The tide's been moving in the right direction, and I think we're living in exciting times. There's still times of danger, and that the world is as dead as it always is, but there are lots of very good things going on in the Catholic Church at the moment.
You've been tuned in to Faith and Reason here on Holy Family Radio. We've been in a conversation with Joseph Pierce, the author most recently of Beauty as Truth and of Race with the Devil. Joseph, it's been just an absolute delight to be able to talk to you, and I look forward very much to your lecture at Aquinas College here in Grand Rapids on September 9th, and I wish you all the best at your new home, the other Aquinas College there in Nashville.
My pleasure, and I look forward to visiting Grand Rapids and Aquinas College very soon.
Thank you, and thank you for tuning in to Faith and Reason on Holy Family Radio.
You've been listening to Faith and Reason with your host, Dr. John Pinero, on Holy Family Radio. If you'd like to listen to this program again or share it with a friend, audio copies are available online at holyfamilyradio.net. Dr. John Pinero is Professor of History and Director of Catholic Studies at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Faith and Reason is brought to you by Holy Family Radio, I'm your program producer, Michael Fiorenzo. Join us next time as we connect the riches of the Catholic intellectual tradition to daily life. Thanks for listening.